Welcome to Five Books for Catholics, where an expert selects and explains five outstanding books on some aspect of Catholic life, doctrine, or culture. Over the last 50 years, it has become customary to frame moral questions surrounding medicine and the treatment of all forms of life under the rubric of bioethics. The rapid development of modern technology opens new possibilities, and with them, a whole range of moral issues. At the same time, many in today's increasingly secularized society question or reject traditional Christian teachings on the sanctity of human life. Indeed, Catholics find themselves defending the gospel of life in an often hostile environment, frequently accused of attempting to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of society. They must also show that the Church's moral teaching on bioethical issues is a matter of right reason and not just revelation. In part one of this interview, Father Michael Baggett recommended five books on bioethics. In this second part, he covers some further recommendations. Father Michael Baggett is Assistant Professor of Bioethics at the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum. He is also a research scholar at the UNESCO Chair in Bioethics and Human Rights in Rome, Italy. He was Adjunct Professor of Theology at Christendom College's Rome program from 2018 to 2022. His writings have appeared in First Things, Studia Bioethica, the National Catholics Bioethics Quarterly, and Medicine, Healthcare, and Philosophy. He is editor and contributor to the book Enhancement, Fit for Humanity, Perspectives on Emerging Technologies, published by Routledge in 2022. Father Michael, now we can go on to discuss your extended shortlist.
Okay.
You recommended three further books. The first one on your extended shortlist is the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith's 2008 instruction, Dignitas Personae. This was widely anticipated because it was expected it would come out in favor of the adoption of embryos, but contrary to expectations, the document sided towards, without categorically eliminating, disqualifying the other position, but favored opposition, ruled out in print and tentatively pro tanto the adoption of embryos. Why have you chosen this document over the same congregation's 1987 instruction, Donum Vitae, the gift of life? I've always felt the early instruction was clearer and better argued.
Yes, that's a good question. Well, I chose the Dignitas Personae document because it is the most recent sort of extended reflection on bioethical issues that we find from what was then the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, is now, the like all other congregations, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith. And so it's the most extended reflection on these matters. At the same time, the document is very clear that it's building upon and in a sense presupposing and integrating the earlier document, Donum Vitae, that you mentioned. And that earlier document is well worth a reading, and I would say highly recommended as well. And in many ways, could be necessary to appreciate fully what Dignitas Personae is doing, what it's trying to develop. Dignitas Personae, having been written in 2008, is also able to benefit from years of further reflection on new technological developments in the area of procreation or in other fields. You mentioned the expectations and the controversy regarding embryo adoption, and as you noted, the congregation basically decided not to make a definitive judgment. So it certainly did not give an unqualified endorsement to embryo adoption. So we don't really see movements in the church, with some exceptions, kind of enthusiastically promoting this practice as part of the culture of life, but at the same time, the congregation chose not to offer a clear condemnation. It certainly indicated that some of the moral concerns that arise in practices of medically assisted reproduction, such as in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer, that some of the same moral concerns that arise in analyzing those procedures that had already been addressed in Donum Vitae could also arise in the moral evaluation of embryo adoption. But again, the text did not, not in my opinion, want to imply that these are morally equivalent, right? That certainly if they were morally equivalent, then embryo adoption would be excluded in the same way that in vitro fertilization and embryo transplantation is excluded as a part of the good moral life. So there's still certainly controversy in that theme. It's important for any Catholic bioethicist or anyone who simply wants to appreciate what the church teaches to be aware of the parameters and principles that the church has placed for reflection on these matters. And within those parameters, Catholic ethicists, bioethicists are invited to contribute to this ongoing reflection. And perhaps, just as we had a sequel to Donum Vitae in Dignitas Personae, we will eventually have a sequel to Dignitas Personae that may very well offer a definitive judgment one way or another on this matter. There are good, faithful Catholic bioethicists who come down on different sides of this issue, whether it's appropriate or not appropriate. Also, Dignitas Personae is interesting, I would say, certainly in my own field of research regarding questions of human enhancement biotechnology, because it is, to my knowledge, the first magisterial document that begins, I would say, begins to explore these issues in looking at possible genetic modification, in looking at other approaches that seek to radically alter human beings through biotechnology, through pharmaceutical products. Here, the reflections, I think, are helpful. They introduce the very standard distinction between therapy and enhancement, between that which contributes to the healing or the repair or the preservation of health, therapy, widely accepted by practically all, versus enhancement, which is understood to be something that goes beyond the goals of therapy. Some use the pithy statement, you know, making us healthier than healthy or better than well, right? So bring us beyond this state of health. And I think that the document understandably raises concerns of a kind of new eugenics, of trying to shape a superior human race, which would stigmatize those who do not have certain qualities and would favor those with certain qualities. It could exacerbate the inequalities in society that we all already face between those who have resources to pursue these greater capacities of cognition, of mood stability, or of delight emotionally, or of those who have the resources to achieve a far greater physical prowess in terms of athletic ability or other aspects of physical beauty or stamina. So again, these raise some pretty serious questions about society and justice and access. But again, the document is just starting to address these concerns that are present, again, within the Catholic Church, and then also in non-Catholic literature about these regards. In the President's Council of Bioethics, these issues were already being dealt with in the early 2000s. But I think there's a lot more work to be done. And like other thinkers in this area, I would move beyond the therapy enhancement dichotomy. I think there could be forms of enhancement that are morally acceptable, so-called therapeutic enhancements that respect all of the goals of a therapeutic procedure, but could bring us to a state beyond the statistical norm of health, but that also that do not inhibit the person or distract the person from pursuing non-physical goods like friendship, intellectual truth, social collaboration, etc. But these are pretty big issues that the document introduces well, but that need to be explored, especially because we are already about a decade and a half away from the document, and it, at least in terms of bioethics, a decade and a half is quite a long time. So well worth a reading together with its earlier bioethics document, sort of elder brother or sister, Donum Vitae.
Next on your bonus list is Charles C. Comissi's Resisting Throwaway Culture. Going by the book's title, it takes its cue from Pope Francis's catchword for a disturbing contemporary trend. Yes. In line with Pope Francis's concerns, the book articulates a consistent life ethic and suggests that care for human life should not be restricted to pro-life policymaking, but also extend to caring for the vulnerable and needy that we meet in our everyday life. Can you share your thoughts on this book and why have you picked it?
Yes. So I think that in many ways, Comissi offers a very good explanation and application of what I was talking about earlier regarding Evangelium Vitae. Evangelium Vitae is clear and unequivocal regarding the evils of abortion, of euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, and other violations of human dignity. And the author, Comissi, is likewise quite clear in this regard. Yet he also wants to remind us of other themes, say regarding poverty, regarding the treatment of pregnant women, regarding the role of women in society, etc., that are also mentioned in Evangelium Vitae and are very much part of our tradition. And he wants to make sure that we are truly creating this whole culture of life, a culture of life that welcomes people at all stages and takes the initiative to meet them in their needs of their vulnerability, of their dependence on support. So he does a good job of showing how these issues relate to each other. And he also helps us to purify, if you will, a term that's been very present in conversations about bioethics, especially in the Catholic world, this kind of idea of a consistent life ethic. Now, unfortunately, this consistent life ethic term and approach has, in my opinion, done damage in the sense that it has sometimes tried to relativize so much traditional themes of bioethics like abortion that these issues start to lose their urgency and that individuals no longer really take them so seriously. They say, well, we have so many other concerns about poverty or environmental issues or criminal justice reform. And so efforts can become very dispersed, and the urgency of confronting clear violations of human dignity can be dampened. That is not by any means Comissi's approach. Rather, he wants us to see that there are concerns at all stages of life, But he does not want to relativize traditional themes or treat all bioethical issues in exactly the same way. Also, just to conclude on Camosi, I think that the strength of his book is his capacity to frame these issues in a manner that can be a little bit more comprehensible to a wider audience. Camosi is well known for his effort to enter into dialogue with Peter Singer, the major secular bioethicist who is by no means on board with the church's teaching. Peter Singer has famously said and written on the fact that he thinks this whole notion of human dignity, of universal human dignity, is a kind of Judeo-Christian doctrine that does not make much sense in a secular world and ought not to be embraced. He's famously said that he supports not only abortion, but infanticide, right? And he thinks that it's dishonest to support abortion without also accepting infanticide, and that there are certain young animals that might be more worthwhile and worthy of protection than infants, say with impaired functions of autonomy or consciousness. So Singer is by no means on board with the Catholic Church, yet the two have engaged in many public dialogues, public debates. They have collaborated on different projects. So I think Camosi really models the way in terms of presenting strong convictions, well-argued convictions to a wider audience and helping them to question their own positions and see whether or not their goals of a just society are really consistent, or whether they need to be changed and adapted.
Coming back to something you've mentioned a couple of times, you've pointed out how both John Paul II in Evangelium Vitae and Camosi stress how there are many different issues which belong to the culture of life or consistent life ethic. It's not just about defending on the unborn or opposing physician-assisted suicide. There are also issues such as the death penalty, immigrants, and so forth. But, and I'm not trying to comment on John Paul II's analysis nor on Camosi's presentation of these themes. But we know that in contemporary debates, as you've already pointed out, there can be a tendency to treat all these issues as if they were on equal standing. And of course, there is a big difference for abortion and physician-assisted suicide are moral absolutes. They're actions which cannot be performed under any circumstances. Whereas when we're dealing with issues such as immigration and so forth, these are not negative precepts of natural law. We're dealing with positive, affirmative precepts of natural law, which are always obligatory, but which it's not possible always to fulfill that obligation in every circumstance, every case that presents itself.
Yes.
There's much more room for discretion in these issues. So whereas every unborn child has a natural right to life and to be immune from threats or actions which would violate it, take away its life, not every immigrant has a natural right to enter into the country of his or her choice.
Right.
So that's why there would be a lot more room for discretion debate on some of those issues, whereas there has to be a categorical opposition to abortion or euthanasia. Could you just expand upon this point?
Yes, no, that's very important, and I would be in full agreement. And I think both John Paul II and Camosi as well. So certainly on some of these issues, there can be a legitimate diversity of approaches to promoting positively the good of respect for immigrants or assistance to those, say, who are fleeing their country for financial motivations or because of political instability, etc. And each country varies in its capacity and its ability to embrace these immigrants while also caring for the needs of its citizens, right? So there can definitely be a legitimate approach to immigration or any sorts of reforms that are necessary to come to the assistance of those who might be starting to flood a country. I mean, I think, for instance, in the situation of appreciation for the difficulties of unborn women, right? So there's nothing, we would say, that could morally justify the killing of her unborn child, right? And so we're quite categorical in that. And I would imagine most agree that we should treat a woman with respect and care and recognize her unique vulnerability in the state of pregnancy and the unique need she has. Now, for some, that might translate in heavy state intervention to provide a very generous payment of maternity leave and so forth. But there are others who may very well be quite concerned and committed to the good of these women who say, well, I wouldn't necessarily support so strong a state intervention. I think that other institutions at a more local level can supply for these needs, the family itself, the extended family, civic organizations, local churches, synagogues, etc. So it's important in these issues, as you've noted, that we leave room for discretion and prudential judgments about the best means to achieve these goals of respecting human dignity, whether the immigrants, the pregnant woman, or those who find themselves in poverty, right? There's a whole host of economic concerns and debates, legitimate debates about the best economic system for any given country to alleviate the negative effects of poverty and ensure that citizens at least have access to workforce and to a living wage and a dignified life for themselves and for their family, right? But there are different models, economic models, that we can certainly debate to as the best means to that goal. And it's important that in these conversations, we do not demonize each other, right? That we are not quick to judge someone, say, as insensitive to the plight of immigrants simply because he points out that his country might need a more stringent immigration policy and might not be as a country in the position to welcome as many immigrants as it is welcoming, or at least in the manner that is welcoming, right? I think it's incorrect and unhelpful to demonize people in that regard. And so a proper distinction between these different issues is always necessary, so long as we're giving due attention to the different bioethical concerns at work in the whole span of human life.
And finally, you've proposed Olcott's Needs, What It Means to Be Human, the Case for the Body in Public Bioethics. What does the author mean by a public bioethics and by making a case for the body?
Yes, so Sneed's a... A very interesting work. Sneed is, he works at the Notre Dame Law School. He is a lawyer and a professor of law. And so he is consistently engaged with matters of public concern and interacting with people who do not share his own Catholic convictions. And over the course of his career, he's become convinced that some of the analyses that we find in other authors like Charles Taylor and reflections that were developed by Carl Elliott regarding the impact of a kind of expressive individualism, that this kind of thought in many ways undergirds a lot of debates about bioethics in the public sphere in a pluralistic society at both the beginning and the end of life. So this notion that each individual has this kind of utterly unique identity that is discovered through this process of introspection, and that in a sense only the individual can find, apart from serious concern about other unchosen commitments or responsibilities that could arise through family or work, and that this personally discovered identity ought then to be respected by those around as is expressed. This kind of philosophy, though it might not really be well articulated in the minds of many, seems to be sort of accepted and then plays out in different ways, and leads to, a lot of this sort of radical personal autonomy that we've alluded to. So we can think today about many issues concerning gender identity. Right, there's a strong sense that we as a society ought to do all we possibly can to respect this utterly unique individual introspective journey that has brought a person to decide, I am a man, I am a woman, I am something else. And that no matter what that person's biological constitution is, right, at a bodily level, that sense of inner self, of personal identity, is paramount and ought to be respected to the point that we as a society will use different pronouns. We as a society will invest money in perhaps suppressing a fundamental process like puberty. We as a society will allow and support this individual to undergo what many in the not so distant past would consider to be simply a bodily mutilation, in order that that individual is able to respect and express that utterly unique personal identity. So this is kind of one example of many others in bioethics where there seems to be this divide, this radical dualism and divide between that inner self and the body. And the body becomes more and more this kind of external raw material that can be manipulated and shaped according to the radical autonomy of the individual. Now, what's interesting about Snead is that he doesn't just stop at this kind of negative analysis or negative critique of this and say, this is bad, this is dangerous, let's not do it. He says that we need to also foster and cultivate in appreciation for what it means to be a bodily being, and the fact that we just are not in practice radically autonomous, that all of us are born into, raised in, and constantly sustained and shaped by a complex, intricate network of dependence and mutual support. He draws on the idea of Alistair MacIntyre, right, the philosopher I mentioned earlier, that all of us live somewhere in this kind of spectrum of disability, right? So in many stages of our life, we might be blessed with generally good health and be able to pursue a lot of life projects with a good deal of autonomy and self-determination. And that's all well and good. But, you know, our dependencies are still there. We have mentors, we have teachers, we have family members, we have spouses who teach us, who encourage us, who support us when we're discouraged or in need. And that kind of dependence is all the more present naturally at the earliest stages of our lives, where even outside of the womb, it's very difficult to describe ourselves as suddenly fully autonomous, right? We have great need for the nurture and care of our parents and for those around us. And then as we advance in life, naturally there's a period of deterioration in terms of physical or even cognitive capacities that demand an even greater dependence on others. So rather than run from or be ashamed of this human finitude that the body brings or this vulnerability and dependence, we ought rather to acknowledge and embrace this mutual dependence and be willing to extend that care and concern for the weak, the frail, and the vulnerable, no matter what the state may be or their capacity for exercising in practice personal autonomy, just as we would hope that others extend to us in our moments of greatest need and vulnerability that same unearned care and concern. So I think it's an interesting take. As I said, there's some profound philosophical, sociological reflections, but given his work, as a lawyer, as a professor of law, he's also does a very good job of bringing this to the very practical decisions that we as a society are making at a legal and political level.
Michael, thank you much for leading us through your extended list of recommendations for the best books.
My pleasure.
Bioethics. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless.